Hello. In the last lecture, we looked at the first several centuries of the Roman Republic, and that was a time when Rome had conquered the entire Italian peninsula. In this lecture, we'll examine the next couple of centuries of the Republic, during which Rome will take over most of the Mediterranean basin. And this expansion begins with a series of conflicts, which will pit Rome against the other major young growing power in the Western Mediterranean, the city-state of Carthage. And the resulting Punic Wars between Rome and Carthage are a true turning point in all of Roman history. They are simultaneously the closest that Rome will ever come to total defeat, but they're also the stepping stone to Rome's ultimate success. They also feature Rome's greatest nemesis, the brilliant Carthaginian general Hannibal. The year 264 BC was a fateful moment for Rome, because in that year, Rome captured the last remaining independent Italian city. And in the same year, Rome got involved in their first overseas conflict. That was the First Punic War against Carthage. Carthage and Rome shared a number of very interesting similarities. Both cities, at least according to legend, were founded around 750 BC. Both cities were located in a centralized, strategic position. In Carthage's case, Carthage was on the coast of North Africa with a very good harbor right at the bottleneck where the Mediterranean Sea was the narrowest. Both cities were centers of a young empire, and both cities were ruled by aristocracies who had very aggressive, expansionist outlooks. Carthage began as a trading outpost of the Phoenician city of Tyre, but eventually the Carthaginians broke away and set up their own empire. And at the time when they come into conflict with Rome, they had already brought most of the local North African tribes under their command. The term Punic War, by the way, is derived from the fact that the Latin word for Phoenician is Punic. Unlike Rome, Carthage did not incorporate its conquered territory, but instead it forced them to pay tribute. Another difference is that while the early Romans were primarily farmers, the Carthaginians were mainly merchants. And so because of this, Carthage had a very large merchant fleet, and they carried on an active trade, both in staple goods and luxury items all over the Mediterranean basin. When the Carthaginians needed an army, they tended to use their wealth to hire mercenaries. But their real military strength was their navy, because to protect their trading ships, they had developed probably the largest, most powerful, most sophisticated navy in the Mediterranean at this time. The political structure of Carthage was a very odd mixture of oligarchy and democracy. But in reality, power was in the hands of a small group of wealthy merchant families. The key to understanding all of the Punic Wars, really, is geography. When you look at a map of the Mediterranean, it's clear that strife between the expanding rival empires of Rome and Carthage is inevitable. Geography also dictates and really explains the place where that war would break out, the island of Sicily. In 264 BC, Sicily lay exactly between their two spheres of influence. It's a key transportation choke point that both empires want to possess. And so predictably, those conflicting interests soon spark an incident that results in a mutual declaration of war. The Romans now had a very serious problem to contend with. They had committed themselves to a war over an island, and it was a war which was to be fought against the dominant naval power of the region. Problem is, Rome has no navy. Even worse, the Romans in general were suspicious of the sea, and they were terrible sailors. But with the usual Roman determination, they decided to build an entire fleet to try and match that of Carthage. And they really didn't have the experience or the knowledge for how to build warships. But they did have a stroke of luck when a Carthaginian warship fell into their hands. So the Romans simply used it as a model and imitated it. And they trained their own rowers by lining them up on benches on the land to practice. The goal of naval battles at this time is usually for one ship to maneuver so as to ram the other and sink it. And this is a strategy which favors the person who has the most nautical skill. Realizing that they could never match the seamanship of the Carthaginians, the Romans came up with a brilliant invention. They attached a long, movable gangplank with a big iron spike at its end to the front of their ships. And in the subsequent battle, they would use this to nail their ship to the Carthaginian one. The Roman marines could then run across the gangplank onto the Carthaginian ship, and effectively, they found a way to turn a naval battle into a land one, which was something the Romans were very good at. So with this strategy, the Romans won, initially, several shocking victories, and they invaded and occupied most of the island of Sicily. Unfortunately, the Romans really never learned to be good sailors. And so when the signs of a storm appeared in the distance, the Roman admirals ignored it. Their fleet was caught in a terrible storm, and by the time the storm had passed, only 80 out of 250 Roman ships were left. Tens of thousands of Romans drowned in one afternoon. But with typical Roman determination, they spent the next 2 years building and training another fleet, which they then sent out. Unfortunately, they still hadn't learned to read the weather, and an even worse storm caught that fleet and sent it to the bottom of the sea as well. Even for the industrious Romans, it took 4 years for them to build and train yet another fleet, and they sent this one out in 249 BC under the command of a man named Publius Claudius Pulcher. Before the battle, Pulcher, as was customary, took the omens. And this consisted of placing several sacred chickens on the deck of the ship, and then scattering grain in front of them. If the chickens ate, it was considered a good omen. But if they refused to eat, it was a bad one. And the more eagerly the chickens ate the grain, the better the omen. In this case, the sacred chickens, maybe they were seasick, refused to eat at all. A terrible omen. Becoming enraged, Pulcher exclaimed, "If the chickens won't eat, then let them drink," and he threw them overboard and they drowned. Well, as you can guess, whether due to the bad omen, the murder of the sacred chickens, or because the Carthaginians had finally learned to avoid those Roman boarding bridges, the Romans were decisively defeated. And just to make things worse, on the way home, the few surviving Roman ships were caught in another storm and wiped out. And as if all of this wasn't bad enough, Carthage at this point finally came up with an excellent land general, a man named Hamilcar Barca. By the way, the name Barca means thunderbolt, and this is a very fitting name because he immediately landed in Sicily and he swiftly recaptured most of the cities. At this point, the Romans' luck finally turned when a new political faction who were opposed to continuing the war took over at Carthage. They dismantled most of the Carthaginian fleet. They refused to send Hamilcar any more supplies or any reinforcements. And meanwhile, Rome had been building and training yet another fleet. And so with it, they were finally able to recapture most of Sicily once again. The two sides then signed a peace treaty in 241 BC. There were three important effects of that first Punic War. First of all, Carthage had to pay a large cash indemnity to Rome, fine. Secondly, Carthage had to give up all claims on Sicily. Third, Rome formally annexed Sicily, and it became the first overseas Roman province. And when Rome does this, it represents an important change in their policy. So the Romans do not immediately share citizenship with the Sicilians. Instead, a Roman magistrate was appointed as governor, and the main requirement imposed on the Sicilians was to pay taxes. They were not given citizenship. And from this point on, that's the way the Romans would treat conquered territories. They would convert them into tax-paying provinces. Now, despite that defeat, Carthage was still really very strong. It wasn't so much that Rome had won that war as that Carthage had sort of given up. And so another conflict between those two young growing empires really was inevitable. And once again, if we look at a map, we can understand where the war starts. Carthage had tried to expand northwards into Sicily, but they'd been thwarted. If they go to the south, there's only desert, so there's nothing there. If they go to the east, they hit Egypt, a powerful country, so they can't go that way. So the obvious logical place, just looking at the map, for Carthage to go next was to the west and to Spain. And so sure enough, Hamilcar lands in Spain and ended up conquering most of the Spanish tribes and bringing them under Carthaginian control. And when Hamilcar went off to Spain, he took with him his 9-year-old son, Hannibal. And according to legend, at least, before they left Carthage, Hamilcar made Hannibal swear everlasting hatred for Rome. Eventually, after a decade or two, Hamilcar died, and his son, Hannibal, then took over his work in Spain. Meanwhile, Rome had begun to expand northward, and they were starting to move along what is today the coast of France. And so the Romans, coming along from France, and the Carthaginians, coming up from Spain, ran into conflict with each other yet again. And the point at which they came into conflict was a city called Saguntum, which was located on the east coast of what today is Spain. And with that event, the Second Punic War broke out in 219 BC. This is the war that would push Rome to the brink of total defeat, because Hannibal, as it turned out, just happened to be one of the greatest military geniuses of all time. Hannibal, I think correctly, diagnosed that the key to Rome's successes was their ability to draw on that huge manpower reserve of Italy, to call on the half-citizens and the allies to just keep making new armies. So Hannibal comes up with a bold plan to separate Rome from that resource. His plan is to invade Italy itself, to win a couple battles, and then hopefully those Italian cities would revolt and turn against Rome in order to regain their independence. Now, to get his army from Spain to Italy, Hannibal adopted another daring plan, which was to cross the Alps, those high, icy mountains that were infested with murderous hill tribes. In 218, Hannibal set out from Spain with an army of about 40,000 men and 37 elephants. Incredibly, he made it across the Alps. Although the ice, the snow, the landslides, and the nasty hill tribes took such a toll that by the time he finally arrived in northern Italy after crossing them, he was down to only 20,000 men, one elephant, and one eye. The Romans promptly sent out an army to try and wipe out Hannibal's small and weakened force. But Hannibal was such a military genius that he figured out a way to completely outwit the Roman commander, and he slaughtered all the Romans. In expected fashion, the Romans went back, drew on their manpower, and raised a second army. And they sent that one out after Hannibal. Again, Hannibal was outnumbered, but cleverly, he drew the Romans into an ambush along a lakeside. It was in the fog, and once again, he wiped them out. The Romans now were beginning to get pretty worried. Here was a guy who seemed able to beat however many armies they sent after him. So this time, they took 2 years to raise not one, but two complete Roman armies, which then march out together under the command of both consuls. This final confrontation happened at a place called Cannae in 216 BC. And the Battle of Cannae is still studied today as an absolute textbook example of brilliant strategy. When two sides lined up for battle in the ancient world, the normal procedure was that you would put your best soldiers in the middle, and you would put the more unreliable ones at the two sides. Hannibal reversed this. He put his best troops to the left and the right. Now, he knew that his weaker soldiers in the middle could not beat the Romans. So he told them, once the battle starts, if you need to, just give ground. Just start to back up as necessary before the Roman advance. So, the battle starts, the Roman center pressed forward, they thought they had the victory. Meanwhile, though, Hannibal's best troops on the left and right side drove off the inferior Roman troops they faced, and then they began to sweep around the Roman center. And in the end, the main body of Roman troops gets completely encircled, and they're attacked from all sides. Their formations break down, and the battle turns into a massacre. In one afternoon, Hannibal's troops hacked to death with swords the incredible sum of 65,000 Romans. And this is carnage on an almost unimaginable scale. This is a battle that ranks among the bloodiest days in all of military history. Just to try and put this in perspective, consider that more Romans were probably killed in this one afternoon than Americans died in the entire 20-plus years of the Vietnam War. The Battle of Cannae was one of the darkest moments in Roman history, and it threw the Romans into an absolute frenzy of panic and despair. In Hannibal, they had finally met an enemy who was able to defeat any number of men that the Romans threw at him. Hannibal marched right up to the gates of Rome itself, but the Romans barricaded themselves in and refused to surrender. And Hannibal, who really didn't have any siege equipment with him, was soon forced to just move on in order to keep his army fed. After the disaster of Cannae, the Romans selected a new leader, and this was a man named Fabius. And Fabius adopted a new strategy. And the core of this strategy was very, very simple. It was, don't give Hannibal the chance to kill any more Romans. So the Romans raised new armies, and they sent them out after Hannibal, and they followed Hannibal everywhere he went. But whenever Hannibal turned to attack, Fabius simply backed off and refused to fight. So as a result, he became known as Fabius Cunctator, which means Fabius the Delayer. And in the aftermath of Cannae, as Hannibal had hoped, some of those Italian cities revolted against Rome and, seeking their independence, came over to his side. But the vast majority of Italian cities remain loyal to Rome, even at this, its time of maximum weakness. And it was really here, in these dark days of the Second Punic War, that Rome's earlier policy of generosity and inclusivity, of sharing citizenship to some degree, bore fruit. So with most of the cities staying loyal to Rome, Hannibal's strategy failed. And poor Hannibal was reduced to roaming up and down Italy, unconquered, undefeated, but frustrated, looking for somebody to fight. That goes on for the next 12 years. So the Romans may have been afraid of Hannibal. They're not going to fight him. They're not going to give him another chance to kill Romans. But they don't have any such fear of other Carthaginian commanders. And so Rome goes back to its manpower, it raises a couple more armies, and it sends those off to Spain. And after some initial setbacks, the Roman command fell to a young general named Publius Cornelius Scipio. And, as chance would have it, Scipio turned out to be another military genius. He conquered all the Carthaginian territories in Spain, and even killed Hannibal's brother. And Hannibal only learned of that when the Romans threw the severed head of his brother into the Carthaginian camp. Scipio next invaded North Africa itself, and by doing so, he forced the Carthaginian government to recall Hannibal and told him to come back to Africa to defend Carthage. The two great commanders, Hannibal and Scipio, finally came together and fought one another in 202 BC at the Battle of Zama. And at that battle, Scipio's generalship proved at least a match for Hannibal, or maybe his troops are simply better than Hannibal's, since Hannibal's troops by now are getting pretty old. But at any rate, Hannibal was defeated. Carthage surrendered in 201 BC, and Rome had won the Second Punic War. There were five important effects of the Second Punic War. First of all, Carthage had to pay a large cash indemnity, a big fine. Second, Spain and North Africa were turned into tax-paying Roman provinces under the control of Roman governors. Third, the city of Carthage had to give up all of its territory and all of its military. And so Carthage now is effectively finished. This is the end of them. The last two effects, though, are not really so much on Carthage, they're on Rome. The fourth effect is that the Roman army simply got a lot better and a lot more professional over the course of the Second Punic War. Under Scipio, it was transformed from what was in reality a militia of citizen soldiers into a professional army with soldiers who serve long-term, careerists. They also adopted new equipment, they had a new sword, new tactics, and from now on, the Romans really would have a distinct qualitative edge over most of the people they fought. And this is really a classic example of that old cliche that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Well, the Romans almost got killed in the Second Punic War, but afterwards, they were a lot stronger. The fifth and last effect of the Punic War, Second Punic War, was that Scipio got lots and lots and lots and lots of dignitas. After all, he was the man who defeated Hannibal and saved Rome. As a result of this, he acquired a new name, and from now on, he would be known as Scipio Africanus, or Scipio, the Conqueror of Africa. And in the long run, this final effect here may be the most important one, because for the first time, the rough equilibrium that had existed among different aristocrats competing for dignitas, competing for prestige, that equilibrium is broken, and it begins now to tilt in favor of just one man. And Scipio, and really Scipio's family, came to dominate affairs at Rome. All right, Rome was now clearly the foremost power in the Western Mediterranean. So next, it turned its attention to the East. And the Eastern Mediterranean was the Hellenistic world. These were the various kingdoms that had been left behind or created by the breakup of the empire of Alexander the Great. And remember, the East is Greek. It tends to be richer, it tends to be more urbanized, and it tends to be more culturally sophisticated. The East was also a little bit of an unknown for the Romans. For example, after one of their early victories of a Roman general over an Eastern kingdom, the Roman Senate actually had to be given a special geography lecture so that they could understand what they had just acquired. The Roman war machine, though, proved too much, it was too efficient, and the Romans conquered even the successors of Alexander the Great. One by one, they're knocked off, and Rome reorganizes their territories into tax-paying Roman provinces under a governor. And Scipio's family continues to dominate. For example, Scipio's brother got one of the key commands to oversee one of these campaigns in the East, and after that, he got to change his name to Scipio Asiaticus, Scipio the Conqueror of Asia. The Roman conquest of Greece and Asia Minor also had two big effects on Rome. First of all, the Romans are exposed to Greek culture. with all of that rich tradition of literature, art, and philosophy that I've already talked about. And when they come back to Rome, they bring this culture with them. They bring it in the form of stolen artwork, they bring it in the form of stolen books or manuscripts, and they bring it in the form of Greeks themselves, because thousands of Greeks get enslaved and transported back to Italy. And often, the educated Greek slaves become tutors to Roman children. They become teachers back at Rome. And so the next generation of Romans is raised knowing Greek culture and having greater cultural sophistication. And a very nice example of this new generation of highly educated Romans can be seen when, in a fit of what's really Hannibal-inspired paranoia, Rome decided to obliterate the helpless city of Carthage. The general given this particular task was, of course, another member of the Scipio family, and he burnt Carthage to the ground and sold all of its inhabitants in slavery. This Scipio, though, was one of these guys from the new generation who had been raised to appreciate Greek culture. And according to legend, as he watched the city burn to the ground, he was moved to recite passages from Homer in flawless Greek about the burning of Troy. So the Romans now are just as brutal, but they recite Greek poetry as they burn your city down. Secondly, as a result of the conquest of the East, Rome and the Romans become rich, really rich, for the first time. Money poured into both the public treasury of the state and the pockets of lucky Romans, especially the generals. By 167 BC, so much money was pouring in from the East that all forms of taxation for Roman citizens could be abolished. And it's been estimated that the revenue of the Roman state increased in this period by a factor of 6. Individual Romans, especially those generals and people like the Scipios, become fabulously wealthy. I'll end this lecture with a paradox. On the surface, Roman imperialism and overseas expansion look like a complete success. Rome has gained wealth, they've gained territory, power, prestige, and culture. But lurking within this apparently happy picture are forces that will soon result in the collapse of the Roman Republic. To put it simply, the paradox was that Rome's success at external conquest resulted in deadly internal tensions. Roman imperialism creates a kind of vicious circle that ultimately ends up making every segment of Roman society unhappy and resentful. Here's how this works. With dreams of becoming rich, many poor Roman farmers sell their farms and join the army. But after decades of serving, a couple of them get rich, but the vast majority return to Italy poor and now homeless. So a lot of them end up hanging around the city of Rome, either unemployed or underemployed. The population of Rome in this period exploded, reaching the phenomenal size of about 1 million people by the first century BC. So, one unforeseen long-term consequence of Roman imperialism was the disruption and the loss of small family farms. Meanwhile, successful generals are coming back to Italy with all this wealth. But what do you do with wealth in the ancient world? You can spend some, but the only real investment you had was to buy land. Well, what do you know? Just as these aristocrats, loaded with cash, are looking to acquire some land, you have all these small family farms being sold or falling into debt and being auctioned off. So the net effect is the Italian countryside is transformed from a whole bunch of little private family farms to a small number of giant plantation-like estates owned by a few rich men. Now, all that land without labor is useless. But what do you know? Coincidentally, Roman imperialism just happened to also be producing an endless supply of cheap labor in the form of slaves, captured in war and sent back to Italy. Roman imperialism creates a huge cycle that feeds upon itself. More wars produce more poor veterans, more generals, more sold-off farms, and more slaves. But in the end, almost everybody involved is unhappy. Quite reasonably, Roman veterans are resentful because they feel they've done their duty for the state, but as a result, they've ended up poor, farmless, and ignored. Quite reasonably, many Roman aristocrats are unhappy because all the wealth and dignitas from these wars is being monopolized by just a few men and families, like the Scipios, and everybody else is being left out. Quite reasonably, the half-citizens and the allies in Italy are unhappy because they feel that by this time they deserve to be granted full Roman citizenship, and they do, and they want to share in the wealth of the conquest. And last, quite reasonably, all those millions of foreigners who have been conquered, enslaved, and shipped off to Italy were unhappy and angry. So, for all its apparent success, Roman imperialism had ultimately produced a huge boiling cauldron of resentment in which almost every segment of Roman society was unhappy and harboring a grievance. And finally, the whole political system, which the Romans had evolved to run a city, was now laboring under the strain of administering an empire. And in the next lecture, we'll see what happens when all that resentment finally boils over and explodes. Thank you.